Albina started to allow herself to dream of marriage and children, of finally moving out of the family home. Her sister Molly, meanwhile, wasn't waiting for any knight in shining armour to come for her. Independent-minded and confident, although unmarried, she left her family to board in an all-female house on Highland Avenue, a tree-lined street in Orange with beautiful detached homes. Molly was still working at the Radium Company, one of the few girls left, but she was brilliant at her job and didn't want to leave. Every morning, she went to work full of energy and enthusiasm, which was more than she could say for some of her colleagues. Marguerite Carlo, who could normally be relied on for a laugh, kept saying she felt tired all the time. Hazel Vincent, meanwhile, felt so run down that she decided to leave. She and Theo weren't yet married, so she got herself a job with the General Electric Company. But her new surroundings didn't improve her condition. Hazel had no idea what was wrong with her. The weight was dropping off her, she felt weak and her jaw ached something rotten. She was so concerned that, in the end, she asked the company doctor at her new firm to examine her, but he was unable to diagnose her illness. The one thing she could be assured of, at least, was that it wasn't her work with radium that was the cause. In October 1920, her former employer was featured in the local news. The residue from radium extraction looked like seaside sand, and the company had offloaded this industrial waste by selling it to schools and playgrounds to use in their children's sandboxes. Kids' shoes were reported to have turned white because of it, while one little boy complained to his mother of a burning sensation in his hands. Yet, in comments that made reassuring reading, von Sochotsky pronounced the sand most hygienic for children to play in, more beneficial than the mud of world-renowned curative baths. Catherine Sharp certainly had no qualms about returning to work for the radium firm when she was headhunted at the end of November 1920 to train the new workers in the watch company studios. These were mostly based in Connecticut, including at the Waterbury Clock Company. Catherine taught scores of girls the method she herself had learned. "I instructed them," she said, "to put the brush in their mouth." The new girls were excited to be working with radium, for the unstoppable craze continued, brought to fever pitch by a visit of Marie Curie to the United States in 1921. In January of that same year, as part of the constant press coverage of the element, von Sochotsky penned an article for American magazine. In it, he opined gravely. "Locked up in radium is the greatest force the world knows. Through a microscope, you can see whirling, powerful, invisible forces, the uses of which," he admitted, "we do not yet understand." He added, as a cliffhanger on which to leave his readers, "What radium means to us today is a great romance in itself, but what it may mean to us tomorrow, no man can foretell." In fact, no man can foretell much, von Sochotsky included. And there was one event in particular that the doctor didn't see coming. In the summer of 1921, he was frozen out of his own company. His co-founder, George Willis, had sold a large share of his stock to the company treasurer, Arthur Roeder. Not long after that, both Willis and von Sochotsky were unceremoniously ousted in a corporate takeover. The newly named United States Radium Corporation, USRC, seemed destined for great things in the post-war world, but von Sochotsky wouldn't be at the helm to guide it through whatever lay ahead. Instead, it was Arthur Roeder who slipped graciously into the vacant president's chair. End of CD 1.